And it is today's Topical Currents, Monday edition, Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Well, new parents think they've reproduced. It's never the case. Actually, what they've done is produce. Each child has individual traits, qualities, and difficulties. But how parents react to these realities can forge a lasting emotional experience. Joining us now is author Andrew Solomon. His latest work is Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. And Andrew Solomon joins us from NPR, New York. Welcome to you, Andrew Solomon.
What a pleasure to be here.
Thank you for joining us. Mr. May we call you Andrew?
You may indeed.
Okay, good. I heard your very powerful TED Talk from April and was really moved by your beginning quote. So if you don't mind, I'd like our listeners to hear that quote.
Even in purely non-religious terms, homosexuality represents a misuse of the sexual faculty. It is a pathetic little second-rate substitute for reality, a pitiable flight from life. As such, it deserves no compassion, it deserves no treatment as minority martyrdom, and it deserves not to be deemed anything but a pernicious sickness. That's from Time magazine in 1966 when I was 3 years old. And last year, the President of the United States came out in favor of gay marriage. And my question.
Hi. Okay.
Hi.
So what I'd like for you to do for us is to please put that quote in context, if you can, and tell us when you became aware of it.
I became aware of the quote relatively recently. I had been working on my book and the issues of identity that it addresses for a long time, and a friend of mine read it someplace and sent it to me by email. And I thought, okay, that's the world I was born into. I thought, when I was born, being gay was an illness, as it says in the quote, nothing but a pernicious sickness. Mm. And now it's an identity and a vital one that has all of this support in the corridors of power. And I was just very intrigued to figure out how something could change from being an illness to being an identity. And really that quote, the idea that that was the mainstream view less than 50 years ago. I mean, it's a shocking quote to hear in the context of how we live now.
It is, indeed.
So what was it like to be a gay son of heterosexual parents? What kind of hurdles did you have to go over?
Well, I, like lots of gay people, I had a family that I think would have preferred that I be straight. There was a certain amount of pressure that came from my parents to be normal and fit in various ways. And I realized quite early on that I was different in some profound sense. And I actually experienced being gay as an illness and as something that was terrible. And I kept it very secret. And I thought that if anyone found out I would have to die, it would be so shameful. And so there was all of this repression that was going on from me. And then eventually I felt I had to tell the world, including my parents, who I really was, and they struggled with it. At the time, I was angry at them for struggling with it. I felt like if they loved me, they should accept me for who I am and just instantly be there. But while working on my book, I realized that love and acceptance are not exactly the same thing, and that my parents had actually always loved me, even though I felt that they were being unloving in that moment. But it took them a while to accept me. It takes most parents a while to accept their children for who those children really are.
True. Now, you write that your mother encouraged your individuality in certain areas, yet you say you wrote the book to forgive your parents. So could you explain that, and have you forgiven them?
I think I have. And really what I wanted to forgive them for was the fact that we had a household in which I felt that my identity, the fact that I was gay, was not going to be welcome news. And I didn't feel that it wouldn't make any difference. They'd all love me just the same. I felt as though it was going to be difficult and traumatic to deal with. And it was difficult and traumatic to deal with. But as I worked on this book, I discovered that most parents are surprised by their children, that some of those surprises are unwelcome, and that reconciling themselves to those unwelcome surprises is always a process. It always takes time. And in the end, I thought my parents didn't take that long to do it. They struggled with it. It made them uncomfortable. They got over it. They wanted me to be happy. And I could see much more clearly that that was a reasonable trajectory when I looked at the struggles of families dealing with children who are different in so many other ways.
Do you think that in many cases, your own included, parents blame themselves for the differences of their children?
Parents are constantly blaming themselves. And they are blaming themselves in part because society at large has tended to blame them. You know, for many years we said people were gay because they had overbearing mothers and passive fathers. We said that people were autistic because they had refrigerator mothers who chilled them out. We said that people had schizophrenia because their parents nurtured an unconscious wish that they not exist. And if we go back a couple of hundred years, there was a theory called imaginationism, which was accepted by the general population, that a child with dwarfism or deformities was caused by the mother's unexpressed lascivious longings. So that social habit of blaming parents is very deeply ingrained, but it's not mostly very productive. By and large, I think that the blaming of parents has been only a disaster. It doesn't help the kids. It doesn't help the parents. It isn't accurate. And I feel we now live in a time in which people are beginning to understand, oh, okay, so my child is different, and my child is a separate person, and his being different isn't a story about me. It's a story about him, and my story has to be how to relate to it.
How about dealing with homophobia when you were young and taunts of youths and that? How'd you deal with it?
There was a lot of that, and I've written about it in my book. I remember when I was in second grade and Bobby Finkel had a birthday party, and he invited everyone in the class but me. And my mother assumed there'd been some error, and she called Mrs. Finkel and said, oh, I just was calling to confirm. Mrs. Finkel said, Bobby doesn't like Andrew, and he doesn't want him at his birthday party. And so the day of that birthday party, everyone else came to school with presents, and at the end of school, I went out to the zoo with my mom and for a hot fudge sundae. I remember when I was a little older, being on the school bus, and there was a kid 2 years older than me who nicknamed me Percy. I had glasses and braces, and I wasn't terribly effeminate or anything, but I wasn't the most masculine, athletic sort of guy. And I can remember being on the bus. It was a 45-minute bus ride with everyone on the bus chanting Percy, Percy, Percy at me. So I dealt with a lot of that. You know, if I had mixed feelings about being gay, there were a lot of social experiences that made me feel like my ways of being different were not welcome and were not accepted and were not even acceptable.
Some of those kids probably wound up coming out later in life.
True.
I hope so.
Would you say that most of the parents you interviewed were more concerned about the challenges facing their children or their own challenges being the parent of a child who's different and the way that changes their identities and their lives?
Acceptance needs to operate at three levels. There's self-acceptance, there's family acceptance, and there's acceptance by the larger society. I became very interested in the family acceptance piece of it because I think family mediates between the individual and the larger society. Now, the influences can extend in any direction. You know, if you have someone with great self-acceptance, it's easier for his parents to accept him. If you live in an accepting society, parents aren't going to be as down on children who are different as if you live in a very conformist one. But I think overall, there is a sense that that families are the kind of mediating force. And part of what they have to do is go through what in classic psychoanalytic terms would be called the passage from narcissism. But, you know, the idea that they see their child as an extension of themselves, you have to see their child as a separate person. That said, the change in the child's identity is a change in the parent's identity. And the parent has to understand, I am not a person with dwarfism or a person with Down syndrome or gay or transgender, but I have a child who is, and I now have to find some common ground with other parents who have gone through this experience and find a community of people who will understand what I'm going through and be able to advise me on it.
We have to take a break. I don't know if this question is too long for a couple of minutes before the break, but some would ask why in writing a book about the profoundly different you would include those with Down syndrome or deafness in the same place that you write about those who become criminals, as if there is a commonality. What is your answer to those who would say that?
I wanted to investigate how parents manage when they have children who aren't what they had in mind when they decided they were going to have kids. And I wanted to look at how the experience of things that are classed as diseases, like deafness and dwarfism and autism and Down syndrome and schizophrenia and severe disabilities, how all of those worked and how parents managed to find meaning in their experiences with those children and life with those children. And I additionally wanted to look at how parents respond to children who commit crimes, who are different from them and alienating and present a challenge to love, not because of their apparent genetic condition, but because of what they do. I wanted to look at families bringing up children conceived in rape to show that the thing that makes the parent and the child have this awkward relationship can be not only what the child does, but also where the child comes from. I wanted to look at prodigies and see how difference can be so unbelievably challenging even when it's positively constructed, and at people who are transgender, because there's really an argument going on about how much that's nature, how much that's nurture, what the correct ways are to respond to it. So I wanted to look at the full kaleidoscope of families of children who are different and see what it is they all have in common.
Have any of those you interviewed for the book objected to their associations with others in the book? I'm just wondering.
Everyone in the book was annoyed at the other chapters and said, what are we doing here? You know, the autistic people said, but we're so much smarter than the people with Down syndrome. And the criminals said, okay, we did something bad, but we're not as weird as those transgender people, and so on and so on. Since the book came out, an awful lot of those people have written to me and said, it turns out we do all have a certain amount of common ground. And a lot of them have said that it's made them feel less lonely to think there is this larger community. I mean, the message of the book in a way is that difference is what unites us, that many, many, many families are dealing with profound differences of one kind or another, and the process of dealing with those differences is quite a universal process, even though the differences may be individual and different.
Has that been gratifying for you?
Oh, enormously gratifying, yes, absolutely.
We're speaking with Andrew Solomon. He's an award-winning journalist and accomplished author, and his latest book is Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. We need to take that break, and we'll be right back.
And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, along with Andrew Solomon. We're discussing his latest book, Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. If you'd like to join in the conversation, you're certainly welcome. 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Also, we can take emails, radio@WLRN.org. radio@WLRN.org. Andrew Solomon, explain the term horizontal identities, which you talk about in the book.
I've posited that there are two kinds of identity. There are vertical identities, which are passed down from parent to child over the generations. So one's ethnicity, one's nationality, usually one's language, frequently one's religion. These are things parents and children have in common. There are some of those vertical identities that seem to be quite difficult, but nobody is attempting to cure them. You can argue that it's easier to be white in the United States today than it is to be black, but nobody is trying to ensure that the next generation of children born to African-American parents come out with creamy skin and yellow hair. Then there are what I've called horizontal identities. Horizontal because they are identities that you arrive at through contact with a peer group, because they're things you don't have in common with your parents. So all of the things that we've looked at, deafness and dwarfism and so on, transgenderism, being gay, they're all identities you don't have in common with your parents. You learn them from the people you get to know. And a lot of the time, parents have tried and society has tried to cure those horizontal identities. And often the people who are subjected to those cures find community in adolescence or thereafter when it comes as a great liberation to them.
Do you think there are any, or do you personally think there are some of those horizontal identities that are better cured than just validated? I'm thinking of deafness, for example, or
better cured than validated.
Yes.
I think that the question of what to cure and what not to cure is a very, very complicated one. There are some aspects to disability in particular which have to do with social circumstances. So if the issue with being deaf is that people laugh at you and jeer at you on the street, that's a social situation that needs to be changed. If the issue involved in being deaf is that it's very inconvenient not to be able to hear because we function in a world that largely relies on oral communication, then that's actually a disability, and it's up to you to decide how you feel about it. But I found in the deaf community in particular that there is a coherent culture, that that culture is organized around the shared use of sign language, and that the people who have membership in that culture find it a very rich and rewarding place to be. And I don't oppose cure, and I don't oppose social acceptance, but I think they should be aware of each other. Each should notice what the other one is doing. And I think parents should attempt to understand what the world is to which their child's difference might open them up when they are making the decision about what kind of cure to look for. Because some of the people in the book had been subjected to very, very traumatic cures, which had had very damaging effects on their lives. Mm-hmm. Others had been cured of things, and it all went quickly and smoothly, and they were fine with it. But we need to think about what to cure and what not to cure.
I remember interviewing Dan Gilbert of Harvard on his book about happiness, and he found conjoined twins who decided they did not want to have the surgery to separate them because that was their existence, that was what they were comfortable with, and they didn't want to be messed with.
That's fascinating. I found a lot of the people in the book said that they didn't want to be, as it were, to be messed with, that they wanted to be who they were. And I found many instances in which people told me stories and or I experienced things in which these children's very difficulties had become the basis for a great intimacy within the family and for some extraordinary people. I think, for instance, of a dwarf I interviewed named Kiki Peck. Her mother, Chrissy, developed breast cancer. Kiki had something called kines dysplasia, which is a very difficult and problematic condition. It means she doesn't have cartilage. It affects her eyes. It affects her joints. She experiences a lot of pain. But her mother developed breast cancer and said that she was going to shave her head. And Kiki, who was 9 at the time, said, "Well, I'll help you do it." And after they were finished, Kiki said, "Now I'm going to shave my head." And her mother said, "What are you talking about? Of course you're not. Why would you do such a thing?" And she said, "I've had a lot of experience of being different, and I know how lonely it can be. So I thought it would be nice for you to have someone who could be different in the same way as you are at the same time." Now, that's an emotional maturity in a child of that age that's almost unimaginable. Would she like not to have all of the pain? Yes, she would like not to have all of the pain. Would she like not to have had the emotional life that she's had as a result of grappling with this difficulty? I don't think so. I think she values that a lot.
How about the feelings of a mother who learns that her son has sexually abused his young cousin? How does that affect her love for that son?
Well, there's a story about that in the book, as you know, and she was, of course, horrified. But when he was arraigned, she went to see him and she said, "This is the worst thing that I could ever possibly hear. There couldn't be anything worse, and I never dreamed there would be anything as bad as this. But I'm still your mother, and I still love you. So now you know there's nothing you can't help tell me, and now you need to work to get better." And I think she remained engaged with him, horrified by what he'd done, but continued to love him. And that young man has now been out of prison for many years, is recently married, is working, is in many ways recovered from the bizarre and troubled person he was when he was brought in.
Not such a good ending for the Klebolds. I'd like to focus on them for a while because you spend quite a bit of time with Sue and Tom Klebold. Of course, they're the parents of Dylan Klebold, who committed or was one of the Columbine massacres. I want you to talk about them and how their parents are coping now. And I'd like to know if you see Dylan differently after spending time with them than you did when you started writing this book.
I do see Dylan differently. I see the whole crime differently. His parents were very surprising to me. I went out to interview them thinking, if I really get to know these people, I'll see what was wrong with this household and why it is that this terrible thing happened. And the more I got to know them, the more bewildered I was. They're lovely, kind, generous people. I happen to be quite fond of my own parents, but I would have been happy to have those people as my parents. They, I think, would be a great family. I was very struck by what the narrative was like for them, and it was summed up to me in some ways when Sue Klebold said at the end of the first weekend that we'd spent doing interviews. We'd done maybe 20 hours of interviews. It was a very exhausting weekend. We were all dropping. Sunday night, we were sitting in the kitchen, and I said, if Dylan were here now, do you know what you'd want to ask him? And Tom said, I sure do. I'd want to ask him what the hell he thought he was doing. And Sue sort of looked at the floor, and she thought for a minute. And then she said, I would ask him to forgive me for being his mother and never knowing what was going on inside his head.
A lot of people really impugn those parents, thinking, how could this be going on under their noses and that they weren't keeping tabs on these kids with the arsenals that they collected?
The parents were giving their kids a little bit of privacy in adolescence, which is what most of the parenting advice says to do. They had no idea what was going on inside of that privacy. Sue Klebold said that the one piece of advice she had after going through this experience was that every parent should break into his child's room, should read all of the journals, should check out everything that was there. They shouldn't give their child a second of privacy. That wasn't the way that she had thought it was right to parent. And actually, it's not the way that it's mostly considered right to parent. And Dylan was very secretive and managed to keep the news of what was going on in his mind and what he was planning very much out of view.
How do they cope with the world around them today? I mean, are they still considered pariahs, and or has it gotten easier for them?
I don't think it will ever get easier, and it won't get easier for two reasons, one of which is the stigma associated with it, which is obviously enormous, but the other is their feelings of unfathomable sadness that a child who they produced and brought up had caused this pain and devastation to other people. I think that even though they didn't cause it, they still feel an enormous amount of sadness about it and a sort of engaged sadness. The stigma, I think, is very real. I mean, they have old friends who knew them before all of this happened. They've made some new friends, I think, since then. But in general, I mean, Sue has described going to the grocery store and giving the clerk her credit card and having the clerk see her name and say, it was the work of Satan, it was the work of Satan, and she has to deal with that all the time.
You were also, you spoke of the many different ways the mothers of children conceived in rape coped with their children, and if you would share some of them with us, because there was quite a range of emotions and feelings from these parents. Could you share some of those?
Absolutely. The women bringing up children conceived in rape were facing, in some ways, the toughest situation of anyone I interviewed or wrote about. They had these children, and there was the mix of their feeling for this child as their own child and the sense that the child was always reminding them of things. As one mother said to me, most mothers, when they don't know what to do, rely on their instincts. But I have to run away from my instincts all the time because they're horrifying. She said, I love my daughter, but she looks like the man who raped me. And when she hugs me, it feels like 1,000 razor blades scraping across my skin. But there were others who said that while they certainly didn't welcome their experience of rape, that they ended up bonding with the children and that things changed in a way. So one said, I used to look at my daughter's eyes and think those are his eyes, the rapist's eyes. But now I have two grandchildren and they have the same eyes and they're our family eyes. And one woman, who was quite a remarkable woman, had been brutally raped when she was 16, had had her career plan, she had hoped to be a doctor, completely derailed, had had all kinds of things that went horribly wrong in her life, but had ultimately, after all of those experiences, ended up bringing up her child and eventually her grandchildren. When I met her, she was 50, and she said, I said to her, do you think much about the people who raped you? And she said, well, I think about them from time to time, she said, but mostly now with pity. And I said, oh, well, pity, because they're so unevolved. And I said, pity? And she said, yes, she said, because one of them has a beautiful daughter and two beautiful grandchildren, and he doesn't know that, and I do. So as it turns out, I'm the lucky one. Which I thought was an extraordinary construction to come up with. And I'll just end with the story that when I was working on the chapter, I wanted to go somewhere where rape was more a regular fact of life than it is here. And I went to Rwanda, where so many women were raped in the genocide. And there was one woman I interviewed while I was there, an incredibly beautiful Tutsi woman who had been raped and abused in the genocide and had then moved on. And I did an interview with her, and she told me her very painful story. And at the end, I said, oh, and do you have any questions for me? Which I think is always a nice thing to ask people at the end of an interview to sort of equalize the power imbalance of the situation. And mostly people in Rwanda had said, will this be published in French? Are you going to use my real name? How long are you staying here? This woman looked at me and said, well, you're in this field of psychology, right? And I said, yes, more or less. And she said, can you tell me how to love my daughter more? And I was so startled, I sort of stepped backwards. And she said, because I want to love her, but when I look at her, I think about what happened to me. And she said it again very insistently, can you tell me how to love my daughter more? And it was only afterwards, too late to say it to her, that I thought how much love there was in that question itself.
Can one learn to love?
Oh, I think we all learn to love. I think, you know, there are some people who are sort of hormonally besotted with their newborn the second it arrives. But I think by and large, love is something that people learn. You learn it, and you learn it in part through caretaking. You know, there's an old chestnut that we not only care for our children because we love them, but also love them because we care for them. And I think that's very true. I think that process of caretaking is a very powerful one, that it has a very profound effect on people's sense of who their child is, and that it's in doing all that caretaking that the bonding takes place. And the bonding, in most of the cases I was writing about at least, was very profound and very real. I mean, I think of one mother who had a son with multiple severe disabilities, and two children actually with severe disabilities, and one of them died tragically through caregiver neglect. And when she interred his ashes, she said, let me bury here the rage I feel to have been twice robbed, once of the child I wanted and once of the son I loved.
We're speaking with Andrew Solomon, and his latest book is Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. If you want to join in the conversation with a question or a comment, the number is 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-9576, or email radio@wlrn.org. Andrew, before we leave the topic of those children conceived in rape, you also were able to speak with some of the children. Did you learn anything from them?
The issue of when to explain to a child that that child came from a rape is a very complicated one. Most instances in which a child came through unusual or different means, it's advised that you talk about it with them from the time they're very little. So, for example, adopted children, you're supposed to tell them they're adopted before they even know what the word means. But rape is both too brutal and too sexual to share with little children. So there tends to be a secret there. And often the child understands there's a secret but doesn't know what the secret is. And the mother must decide at what point she's going to actually tell the child what happened. And the child is almost always traumatized by receiving that information. So that's really the trick of it. And the question is, how do you tell your child? And of course, there are obvious things. You say, you know, I didn't want to be raped, but then you came and were the great light of my life, and so on and so forth. The child is still going to struggle with that. It's not easy to know that, as one child of rape put it, half my genes came from a monster.
I wonder what effect it has on siblings who weren't the product of rape.
Well, I mean, there are various ways that families get constructed. Some of the women I interviewed had not married and had not had other children. A few already had children. A number had children after this happened. By and large, I found that once the children arrived and manifested their real personalities, they got deeply integrated into the structure of the family. So I didn't see a lot of families in which, the natural children were the sort of apple of everyone's eye and the child of rape was pushed out to the edges. But it can make the child of rape, when the child of rape finds out that that's what he or she is, can make that child feel marginal, even in a family in which he is, in fact, deeply beloved.
Did some parents choose not to tell their children, ever?
I met a few parents who seemed not to have told their children ever, and I think that that happens a good bit. The problem is that it's difficult to keep that kind of secret 100% and forever. And a lot of these women had had children under unlikely circumstances or at the wrong age, or, you know, there were always going to be questions, but why did you have a baby when you were 16? And whatever happened to my father, and why don't you know what his name was, and so on and so forth. It's a difficult secret to keep, but some people do try to do so.
We have an emailer, Evan. It's interesting because I was going to ask you why they called you Percy on the bus. And Evan writes that Percy Dove Tonsils was an Ernie Kovacs caricature of an effete, thick glasses intellectual type. Are you aware of that?
I hadn't been aware of that. I thought it was just a sort of generally considered and not particularly masculine name, but that makes perfect sense.
Yeah, interesting.
I have contact lenses now.
Well, sticking with you for a minute, you made the decision to become a parent during the 11 years it took you to write this book. Why, and weren't you apprehensive in any way, or?
You know, people said to me, how can you possibly be deciding to be a parent in the middle of a book about everything that can go wrong? And I had to say over and over again, it's not a book about everything that can go wrong. It's a book about how much love and joy there can be even when things appear to be going wrong. And I feel like in many ways, the book gave me the courage to have children. I thought if all of these people could love all of these children under all of these extreme circumstances, then I'm going to be able to love the child I have, and we're going to be okay in this.
Tell us a little bit about your family, because it's pretty, would you say, diverse?
I was waiting to see what word was at the end of that sentence.
I didn't know a good one.
So my husband is the biological father of two children with some lesbian friends in Minneapolis. I have a close friend from college who had gone through a divorce and wanted a child, and she and I now have a daughter who lives with her mother in Texas but comes to visit often and is in town right now. And then my husband and I decided we wanted to have a child we could bring up full-time in our own house, and so we have a son who I'm the biological father. We had an egg donor, and our surrogate for the pregnancy was Laura, the lesbian mother of John's two biological children in Minneapolis.
Yeah. I can't figure this out even.
parents of four children in three states.
Yeah, I'm trying to. And let me ask you, do you consider yourself to be a good parent? What does that mean to you?
I sure hope so. I sure hope so. I give it a lot of thought and spend a lot of time on it. The first requisite, I think, is to love your children and make sure that they always feel deeply, profoundly, and permanently beloved. And then beyond that, to help them to realize their potential, to help them to develop a coherent system of values, to make them safe and make them feel secure, to emphasize what it means to be a good person, and to have fun with them and bring joy into their lives. I think those are sort of the primary objectives.
Now, I was going to ask you if any of them are profoundly different, but it occurs to me that just because of the situation, they are. I mean, the five parents of four children in three states makes them different in some ways.
They are different in some ways, and they will, at various stages, have to explain their families. When my daughter went to her preschool interview, she was asked to do a little drawing of her family. And she looked at the person who had given her the assignment and said, it's going to take me all day. So that's the reality for them. There is some difference there. But I looked at all of these families and I looked at what a lot of these children had been up against. And I thought, everybody who has children brings children into the world in a way that's complicated and possibly problematic. Some people have children in poverty, even though it's difficult to grow up in poverty. Some people have children in relationships that aren't going to last, and they end up bringing the children up in single-parent families. Some people who don't have, other intellectual abilities have children, even though the lack of intellectual abilities can be a handicap. And I thought, these children will have to deal some of the time with the fact that where they come from is a little bit different. But I think that they'll mostly really know that they're beloved and be able to defend against that. And if that's the worst problem they have, we'll have done a really good job.
Let's take a phone call or two from listeners. This is Lena in Miami. Hi.
Yes, hi. How are you?
Okay.
I just wanted to know, my daughter was molested by my husband, which he was a good husband to me, but yet did this to my daughter. And I just feel that is it okay for me to have feelings towards him, even though I love my daughter, and he's paying for this, but I don't know if it's something that I should say, well, I shouldn't have any type of feelings. I should hate him. But at the same time, I feel, pain for him, too.
Was there any criminal charges filed?
Yes.
Andrew?
Wow. I think the word should and the word feeling don't often belong in a sentence together, because I think your feelings are your feelings, and you feel whatever you feel. So I don't know whether saying what you should feel hatred. You can't just decide to feel hatred and feel hatred. It's there or it isn't there. It's a pretty serious violation for him to have done that. And I wonder what effect it's had on your daughter, and whether when you see the effect it's had on your daughter, it actually mitigates or alters some of your affection for him. I think it's a terribly complicated situation. And
have you had any counseling, Lena?
Yes, we've had, and things are much better, and she's doing great. He's waiting to be sentenced. It's just, it was so hard for me. From one minute to the other, my life's just changed from having a wonderful husband, a wonderful partner, and to finding out that something terrible like this had happened.
I can only begin to imagine how traumatic that would be. I would say, though, in keeping with the story I told about the young man who had been molesting his niece, that people are capable of growing past these things, and they're capable of understanding what they've done and expressing their regret. That will never fix the difficulties your daughter has. But on the other hand, if he's someone who's been loving in other ways, then it's perhaps appropriate for you to try to get him to a sort of better place, and to try to see him through this time, not forgiving something that sounds unforgivable, but recognizing that he may wish to change and that he's haunted by demons that it's hard for the rest of us to know.
Right. He's very sorry for what he did, and he's like, again, accepted God in his life and all that. It's basically me that I feel that, sometimes I think, well, I shouldn't, even think about, forgiving him or just moving on. He's not the father of my daughter. He's the stepdad. But this is a man that was very, very loving, wonderful to me. A man who was very attentive, a man that was loved by everybody, had a lot of friends, and, liked. And very outgoing and very helpful to other people. So it was very hard for me to understand how he'd be capable of doing what he did. But it's just that, I've been through a lot of emotions, and how should I, feel about this, if it's normal or not normal for me to still feel any type of love towards him.
It's normal to feel love, and it's normal also probably to feel outrage, and how you choose to work with that love and how you choose to manifest it and how you what you need to do in order to make your daughter feel that you've paid attention to her trauma.
Right.
Those are things that you'll have to figure out.
I took action Yeah, I took action immediately when it happened. I mean, and I've taken her, and everybody tells me that she's fine, she's fine. I don't have nothing to worry about her. She's a teenager. She'll do well in life. They basically, when I go to therapy, they tell me, I'm basically the one who needs a little bit more help. But I just wanted to know if it's something normal from the cases that you've interviewed and people that you've come across to, that, you know, it will be normal for me to feel this way.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for your call, Lena.
Thank you.
Our sympathies.
All the best to you and your daughter, your family.
Absolutely.
We're speaking with Andrew Solomon. He's an award-winning journalist, an accomplished author, and his latest book is Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. On today's Topical Currents, we're going to take another break, and we'll be right back. Thanks for joining us for Topical Currents on this Monday. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and we're speaking with Andrew Solomon, award-winning journalist and accomplished author. His latest book is Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. Andrew, we have an emailer from Monica, email from Monica. Hi, I have a daughter with autism, and we've learned to accept her. Now what we still struggle with is society in general, and how I deal with it is by making people aware of her identity right away. It may sound a bit harsh, but brings people down to earth, so to speak. It works for me in the sense that I get what I'm looking for, tolerance and acceptance.
I think that sounds like a very smart way to go about it. Autism, of course, has elements of being an illness and elements of being an identity, back to that division we talked about at the top of the show. Mm-hmm. And the illness part of it is the part that you want to try to treat as much as you can to help your autistic child to function as well as he or she is able to. But you're not going to make the autism go away. And so you also have to learn a way to value your child as a person with autism, to recognize that there is merit and pleasure in autistic lives, and to try to make the world as safe as possible a place for your child to be, in which you do by changing social attitudes. And those attitudes are really beginning to shift, partly because of the enormous population frequency of autism. It's rare to find someone who doesn't have some connection to somebody who has autism in this day and age. But the work of parents, of saying who their child is, of declaring, this is my child, this is what she's like, this is how I feel about her, that's a very courageous stance. As the mother of one transgender woman said to me, she said that she had had a party and she invited all her friends over to tell them about the fact that her child had transitioned. And she said, she's a good person, she's a kind person, she's a loving person, she's my wonderful daughter. That's all I need to know. Mm. Do any of you need to know anything else? It was a very powerful statement, and I think it fits for what Monica is describing.
Andrew Solomon, we're getting a little bit short on time, but could you touch on average parents who have a prodigy amidst the family? You write about a kid who understood the theory of relativity at age 3 and went to college at age 9. That must be very difficult for some parents.
In the same way that it's very difficult if you have the mind of a 3-year-old in the body of a 30-year-old, it's very difficult if you have the mind of a 30-year-old in the body of a 3-year-old. When you have that kind of asynchrony, which is what it's called, you have to make a choice. Either your child is spending time with other people who understand what he's interested in, but are mostly not keen to make friends with a 3-year-old, or your child is spending time with other 3-year-olds who have absolutely not the slightest idea what he's talking about. And so you're constantly having to sort of shift back and forth between those extremes. I found the process of looking at prodigies really interesting. Several of the people who had children who were prodigies said to me that it was like disability, and it really was in many ways. The parents had to become educated about something they probably didn't know much about. They had to engage with a world that was very different from the world that they had imagined engaging with. They had to figure out how to nurture a child like this and find him a context in which he could feel comfortable with other people who were sort of like him. So a lot of the same missions and objectives. And a lot of the time, it was very difficult to figure out. You know, there was one mother who had a son who was, when I met him, I think he was 7. He was quite small and looked like he was 5. He was doing international concert touring. He was taking piano lessons in California, where he lived, a few weeks of the month, and then once a month going to Shanghai for lessons in Shanghai, because his mother thought that you learn different technique in China. It just sort of went on and on. And I said to her, "Do you worry about his having a normal childhood?" At which point the little boy said, "I have a normal childhood. Do you want to come up and see my room? It's kind of messy, but you can see it anyway." And we went upstairs, and he showed me his favorite cartoons, and I noticed the stack of Sesame Street videos next to the TV. He said, "Okay," he said, "that was fun. Now should we go downstairs, and I'll play you the Chopin Fantasy Impromptu?" So we went downstairs, and he played the Chopin Fantasy Impromptu with such adult yearning and such exquisite, elegant technique. And I sat there and listened to him. He's named Mark Yu. He's an amazing pianist. And when he finished, his mother turned to me and said, "You see? He's not a normal child. Why should he have a normal childhood?" And I thought, there's something in that.
Well, I have so many more questions for you, but unfortunately, we are out of time. Andrew Solomon, his journalism appears frequently in the pages of The New Yorker and New York Times Magazine, among others. And his most recent book, which won the National Book Critics Circle Award, is Far From the Tree: Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. We thank you so much for being with us. I'll have to save my questions till the next time.
I look forward to it.
Thank you so much.
And thanks for tuning in this hour. Rather interesting. Our producer is Richard Ive, technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. We have free audio archives and downloads of previous programs at our website, WLRN.org, and more information and links at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Drop us a like if you would. Tomorrow's program studies the psychopath. What distinguishes the brain patterns of a serial killer versus so-called normal people? Neuroscientist James Fallon found his own brain scan indicated he had psychopathic traits. And to the calendar, on this day in 1770, 243 years ago, the birth of Ludwig von Beethoven in Bonn, Germany, where he studied with Haydn. He's viewed as the most important figure between the classical and romantic periods. Of course, he suffered hearing loss and tinnitus. And on this day in 1899, 114 years ago, the birth of actor, playwright, and composer Sir Noel Coward in Middlesex. He had 39 plays produced and was the consummate master of the musical revue. One more while we relish tangy teriyaki boneless chicken wings. On this day in 1980, 33 years ago, the death of Colonel Harlan Sanders at age 90. A seventh grade dropout, he parlayed fried chicken from his Kentucky gas station to a worldwide phenomenon. Finger licking good? Besides the 12 secret spices, pressure cooking is the trick to KFC. So we leave with the advice from thespian Sir Noel Coward, knighted in 1970, quote, "Just say the lines and don't trip over the furniture." Joseph Cooper with Bonnie Berman. Next up, it's Here and Now from NPR News.